Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And it is Saturday. The vault hangs open and we journey inside. But this time, is it so much a vault or is it more a crypt? Is it a burial vault full of grave flesh?
Well, you know how the ghouls operate, Joel. The ghouls are always tunneling between one subterranean structure and the next. So they might have began in the catacombs, they might have began in a tomb, but they ended up burrowing their way into the Stuff to Blow Your Mind vault at some point. And now they pretty much have the run of the place.
This episode was originally published on October 29th, 2015. It was an October classic from a few years ago. So we hope you enjoy our exploration of the ghoul.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
A man he had known in Boston, a painter of strange pictures with a secret studio in an ancient and unhallowed alley near a graveyard, had actually made friends with the ghouls and had taught him to understand the simpler part of their disgusting meeping and blibbering.
For all their laughter, ghouls are a dull lot. Hunger is the fire in which they burn, and it burns hotter than the hunger for power over men, or for knowledge of the gods in a crazed mortal. It vaporizes delicacy and leaves behind only a slag of anger and lust.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And those were two quick readings. The first from H.P. Lovecraft's The Dream Quest of Unknown Caddith, and the second from Brian McNaughton's The Throne of Bones, available via Wildside Press. And that, by the way, is not only one of my favorite publications that deal with ghouls, it's probably one of my favorite books of all time.
Now, do you love it more than the D&D Monster Manual?
Well, the two different types of reads there. I mean, I do love the Monster Manual for my sort of catalog-oriented monster consideration. And indeed, ghouls have long had a cherished role in the Dungeons & Dragons setting.
So what is Throne of Bones about?
Throne of Bones is it's a collection of short stories in one central novella set in a dark fantasy setting that's vaguely Roman, vaguely Tolkien-esque, I guess, but has more in common with the works of, say, Clark Ashton Smith and some of the weird dark fantasy writers of an earlier time.
Oh, I should get into that because I've recently discovered that I really dig Roman themes in dark literature because on your and Christian's recommendation, I read The Great God Pan, which has that fantastic reference to the statues from ancient Rome of the horrific visage of the goat god, the old goat skin.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I love about McNaughton's work is that he brings this dark seriousness of weird fiction and horror into his writing. But there's also this gallows humor. There's this especially prominent with the ghouls, because the ghoul is this creature that in the versions that I like the most, they're gross, they're evil, they're sly, but they're also a little mischievous. They also have this weird black sense of humor about them. And I feel like McNaughton, it really brings that to life.
Well, if you haven't figured it out by now, we're going to be talking about ghouls today. And sadly, I think this is going to have to be our final October podcast. It has been a great run this month of monsters and demons and madness.
Yeah, we're going to have to sober up in the next episode a little bit and get back on track for the holidays. But yeah, it's been a fun ride.
Okay, so ghouls. I think these days when the average person is presented with the concept of a ghoul, what kind of descriptive features are you going to get? I would say they'd be very generic. I mean, what is a ghoul to us today? It's just some kind of vaguely monstrous creature. In fact, you could even think of ghoul as a broader term into which other monsters fit, like the vampire is a type of ghoul.
Well, the word is used that way a lot. I have to admit that I have to bite my tongue to keep from correcting people when someone refers to a non-ghoul as a ghoul. I want to say, no, that's technically not a ghoul. That is just a ghost. That is somebody in a vampire costume. A ghoul is a specific thing. And you have to use the term appropriately.
Yeah, well, I brought that up specifically to provoke you. So, Robert, come on, tell me, what is a ghoul really?
All right, so it's gonna vary, and we're gonna get in before we end up at discussing actual science behind the ghoul. So, yes, that is coming in the second half. We're gonna discuss the ancient roots and sort of the modern fictional roots. But in most cases, you're looking at this creature that might be unliving, or maybe it's just living on the margins of what we think of as an actual, you know, appropriate member of the natural world.
It's very much the monster as outsider motif.
Very much so, yeah. Making its home, graveyards and places of loss and death, and it feasts upon human remains. So it is essentially a cannibalistic scavenger.
And scavenger in the true sense in that it sort of dwells at the edges of the camp. You know, you have civilization as the encampment where our activity dwells. You don't find the ghoul in the middle of the city. You find the ghoul trailing behind you, feasting on what you leave behind.
Right. Yeah, I think in some cases you have ghouls that are following armies. I always love that motif and would love to see that that used more, especially in the fantasy settings. You have some sort of army going out to fight a battle, as they always do. Well, then surely there are camp followers and there are ghouls right behind them.
Yeah, the other type of camp follower.
Yeah.
But based on what we've said so far, it should be clear that the concept of the ghoul has not remained static over time. I mean, it's not even fully unified today. You've got this generic ghoul, and then you've got Robert's very specific ghoul. How has the ghoul changed over time, and where did the idea originally come from?
All right. Well, let's go back to the beginnings then, if not the beginning of the universe, because we have to look at pre-Islamic Arabic mythology.
This mythology is so cool, and I was so delighted to read it. So our main source on this is a paper by Ahmed Al-Rawi called The Mythical Ghoul in Arabic Culture, and this was a really fun read.
Yes, it was. This was one of my key sources on the How Stuff Works article, How Ghouls Work. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he gets into the just the original root of the word for starters, which is from the Arabic ghoul or G-H-U-L that may stem from galu, which is the name of an ancient demon, correct?
And the Galu played a role in some of their key literature and mythology, one of them being the death and rebirth mythology of the god Damuzi, or the Damuzi is sort of equal to Tammuz, which is another god of the ancient Middle East. But the death and rebirth mythology corresponds to the growth and harvest cycle of food crops. So there you can see another one of the ways that that our mythology ties into our way of life, the way we make a living, and our basic material concerns inform the stories we tell about, you know, the creation of the world and the behavior of the gods. And there you've got, just like the crops die every year and then are reborn later in the next season or regrow out of the dead fields of the previous harvest. Mm-hmm. You've got the god Damuzi, or Tammuz, who's a vegetation god who is abducted and taken down into the realm of death. And who is the abductor of Damuzi or Tammuz? It's the Galu, the demon.
Right. And this is fascinating, too, because we see the ghoul tied into some of our earliest and most powerful myths concerning the flow of the seasons.
Totally.
Yeah.
But following its role in the official mythology of ancient Babylon and ancient Mesopotamia, you have this idea of the ghoul emerging as more of a ground-level folkloric creature, you know, that, mm-hmm. that it's mentioned all in all of the standard mythology and folk tales and superstitions of the average person living in the Arabian Peninsula. And Arabic scholars have actually documented the way in which this monster emerged in the thinking of the people.
Yeah, Arabic scholars of the 8th, 9th, and 10th centuries, they compiled various Bedouin folk tales involving ghouls. And many of these found their way into the collection, The Thousand and One Nights. And this is key because translations of this book, of course, traveled to Europe in the 18th century, as did the notion of the ghoul. And this is where, as we'll get into later, we see the ghoul emerge in Western culture and eventually in fictional creations of the late 18th century and, most importantly, the 19th, 20th century.
Yeah, so I get the feeling it's more the European grave ghoul that ends up becoming the D&D monster.
Yes, though you do see at times, say, the modern motifs kind of reaching back into Arabic folklore for some additional depth.
Yeah, I figure we should mention a couple of these pre-Islamic ghoul accounts because they are fascinating. Mm-hmm. So one of the stories that Al-Rawi tells in his paper is that it's recounted according to the scholar Al-Masudi, and he writes the following. Arabs before Islam believed that when God created genies from the gusts of fire, he made from this type of fire their female part, but one of their eggs was split in two. Hence the Kutrub, which looked like a cat, was created. As for the devils, they came from another egg and settled in the seas. Other evil creatures, such as the Marid, inhabited the islands. The Ghoul resided in the wilderness, and the Silwa dwelt in the lavatories and waste areas, and the Hama lived in the air in the form of a flying snake. So these are some awesome monsters that are being described here. I love the idea of a lavatory and waste area monster.
Yeah, because that's a wonderful place for a haunting. That's a wonderful borderland, right?
Well, it's a place where you're vulnerable and usually where you're isolated, right? Mm-hmm. Where do you have to go off by yourself?
Yeah, and that's where you might encounter the supernatural.
But then, of course, there is another source that says that, quote, the devils wanted to eavesdrop on heaven, so God threw meteors at them, whereupon some were burnt, fell into the sea, and later turned into crocodiles, while others dropped onto the ground and changed into ghouls.
Huh.
So there you've got a ghoul origin and a crocodile origin at the same
time. Right up. They're essentially siblings. Huh.
And plenty of the other stories also depict the ghoul as a shapeshifter that's able to disguise its appearance. Mm-hmm. This appears to be a common feature. Other common features are that the traditional Arabic ghoul is often female in appearance. And I thought this was interesting. It can be killed with a good chop from a sword. And if I'm reading this right, it sort of makes it different from the vampire, the werewolf, and these other monsters, which can often only be killed through magically appropriate means. Like, you have to have the one magic bullet that is known to kill the monster. It has to be silver or holy water or staked through the heart or whatever it is for that monster individually. The ghoul can be killed by violence, But it does have to be a very mighty and strategic form of violence, because an interesting development on the myth is that according to some versions, the ghoul would only die if you hit it with one mighty blow with a sword, because if you hit it more than once, then you would have to hit it 1,000 times more before it would die.
Huh. Yeah, that's...
So you had to time your one strike, you know, you had to get the one really good one in.
Well, that could, I could see that making sense in terms of the creature. You sort of have to get that surprise hit in. You got to get that, to put it in D&D terms, you have to get that that surprise attack bonus, right?
Right.
And if you don't, then you're going to have to apply a lot of smaller attacks to win. I've also read, and this would, of course, be post Islamic interpretations, but in these interpretations, you could also at least drive the ghoul away with readings from the Quran.
Yeah, that definitely comes up later, where you can use the holy or spiritual power of a good spiritual force by like saying the name of Allah or by quoting from the Quran, and that will tend to drive it into remission. Essentially, it'll say, "No, why'd you do this to me?" But you can also whack it with the sword, as long as you whack it really good just once.
Now, speaking of Islamic traditions, you're probably wondering, what did Muhammad have to say about ghouls? Well, Muhammad's words on the existence of ghouls vary depending on which text you read.
Yeah.
So the Quran does not mention them at all. That's important to stress here.
The Quran does mention jinn, but not ghouls.
Yes. But contested references do pop up in the Hadith. That's a book of Muhammad's attributed acts and sayings.
Yeah, so there are definitely conflicting bits of scholarship about what Muhammad had to say about ghouls, if anything.
Right.
But to quote al-Rawi again on the people who do say that the Prophet had something to say about ghouls, what he said was, quote, "Ghouls are the demons or enchantresses of genies that hurt human beings by eating or spoiling their food or by frightening travelers when they're in the wilderness. And in order to avoid their harm, one can recite a verse from the Holy Quran or call for prayer, since they hate any reference to God."
Huh.
And that first part mentions something about the wilderness. This is something that pops up again and again in the literature about the ghouls, you know, these ancient ghoul folktales. Is you don't expect to encounter them in the middle of civilization. You encounter them on the road, in the wilderness, between places. They're in that intermediary world.
I like, too, how this mentions eating and spoiling of food. It's tied inherently to our survival via consumption of food and the potential violation of that food, and just into general ideas of purity and cleanliness in our food.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you certainly don't want something that eats corpse flesh getting into your pantry.
Right, yeah. They're just going to tear it up in there, obviously.
But you may have noticed that so far there hasn't been a whole lot, if anything, about the eating of corpse flesh.
That's right.
And that's something that we'll get into in a bit.
Now, in some accounts, Muhammad dismisses ghouls as completely non-existent. Mm-hmm. In others, he gives advice on banishing them. His companion, though, Abu Asad al-Sadi, takes a more balanced approach, and he states that ghouls lived in the pre-Islamic past, but that Allah no longer permits them to exist. Meanwhile, there's also a legend that Umar bin al-Khattab, another of Muhammad's companions, put a ghoul to the sword on the road to Syria.
Yeah, this was great. So the story goes, a female ghoul stops him on the road and asks him, "Where are you going?" And Umar says, "It is none of her business." And then she does the move from The Exorcist, where she turns her head all the way around. That's part of the story. It said that. And then he splits her down the middle with the sword.
All right. So single blow there.
Right. Yeah. He does it right. He hits her with the one blow. But then later he comes back and the body is gone.
Ah. So either she survived, or the other ghouls came and took her body away, or some sort of magical disappearance.
Yeah. So if we consider the ghoul that eats human flesh a kind of perversion of the idea of corpse cannibalism, what is the ghoul that eats ghoul flesh? It's like meta-cannibalism.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and it certainly ties in with how we see scavengers behave towards their own sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's key here, because although ghouls were sometimes associated with scavenging hyenas in Arabic texts,
they really don't have this grave ghoul association where they're going to come and take your dead loved ones from the graveyard after the funeral and eat their corpses.
Yeah, this particular detail, according to al-Rawi, seems to emerge from Anton Galland's French translation of The Thousand and One Nights in the early 18th century. So not only did Galland take liberties in his translation, he even introduced and allegedly created a female character named Amina, who prefers the company of graveyard ghouls to that of her new husband.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so this, and you can see this definitely appealing to some of the Gothic sensibilities of the time in Europe, right?
Yeah.
But this inaccurate translation was hugely influential in the Western world and in, you know, informing the Western world's understanding of the Middle East. So inspiring the work of William Beckford, the 18th century author of the Arabian-themed novel Vathek, and the folkloric studies of another individual named Sabine Baring Gould. So we see, so that's interesting that you have this rich tradition of ghouls in the Arabic traditions. Just some wonderful details there, already a fabulous creature. But then it gets tweaked a little bit, either in, you know, mistranslation or creative embellishment of the myth as it translates into European fiction and folklore and European understandings of the Middle East.
Yeah, it's fascinating, this evolution of the ghoul meme, because if you trace the ancient pre-Islamic Arabic ghoul up through the way the grave ghoul comes to be understood in European culture, what's the common thread there?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've seen the evolution basically of a word, the word ghoul, but is there a common thematic element that remains the same throughout it, despite just general monstrousness or malevolence?
Yeah, I think it works. Like, I feel like that the ghoul, as we have seen it and discussed it in pre-European traditions, I feel like it's able to take on the mantle of corpse eating rather honestly. Like, it adds another dimension to it and certainly tweaks it in a new direction, but not in a direction that feels out of character with its origins.
Okay, I can accept that. Now, if we look elsewhere in the world, do we find myths of creatures that are similar to the ghoul?
We do. It's definitely worth noting that even if the original Arabic ghouls didn't eat corpses, they have peers in Asian folk tales that do. So in the Tamil mythology of India, they have the shaggy-haired creatures known as the Pei, who sought out human battle so as to lap blood from the open wounds of the dying. Still other ghouls emerge in the 8th century Tibetan Book of the Dead, which details the Buddhist journey through death and into the realms beyond death via reincarnation.
Okay.
Here, in the dreamlike state known as Bardo, the departed soul encounters the Pisashid ghouls, and these are fierce female beings with bestial heads and an appetite for bones and viscera.
Wow, that's interesting. Now, another thing that we see commonly here is that in these early visions, the ghouls are very often female, like explicitly described as female in appearance, whereas the ghouls that I think we think of today tend to be either sort of androgynous, tending toward masculine or fully male.
Yeah, I think there is a definite tendency to generate a masculine idea of the ghoul in Western culture. Though some of my favorite books on the matter definitely have female ghouls.
Now, in the conclusion of his article, al-Rawi, he says that the ghouls may have been inspired just by, you know, things that people actually did encounter in reality, like people with various birth defects.
Yeah, particularly things like cleft palate, cleft lip, distortions of the mouth and facial features, you know, which sadly do can and do interfere in our interpretation of an individual substance.
Yeah, I think this is a common feature you see in the origins of monster legends. This is often hypothesized that we would just see someone that that had, you know, some kind of atypical way of looking. And that we would interpret that as, well, you know, this person is cursed or evil or there's something wrong with them. They didn't have the light of modern medical science to just say, no, they're a person like anybody else.
Yeah, very much in keeping with the changeling traditions that you find in Europe, right? That surely that this your actual child was taken away by fairies and this is the goblin that's left in its place.
Yeah.
Now, on top of that, Victorian adventurer and Middle Eastern scholar and just all-around fascinating individual, Captain Sir Richard Francis Burton, he explained the Arabic ghoul as a mythical creature that embodies human fears and taboos concerning graveyards, check, desert wastes, check, and cannibalism, and specifically survival cannibalism, if we're to tie it into other myth cycles, that, such as the Wendigo, that definitely have such a strong resonant place in the native peoples of North America, because it's tied with that fear of survival cannibalism as a possible necessity during harsh winters.
Yeah. I can see a very strong sort of a theme emerging, which is that all of these disparate things are sort of united by the sense that they're playing on fears of the periphery, the edges, the outside, and the taboo, as many monsters do.
Yes.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562 314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So, as previously mentioned, 1001 Nights serves as this cultural bridge, and it's kind of a slightly distorted cultural bridge by which Middle Eastern ghouls migrate into Western fictional traditions. And in addition to the above examples, in the original Arabic text, the ghouls of 1001 Nights are also vile tricksters, and depending on, again, those translations, they may be flesh eaters. They kidnap victims, they lure lustful men to their doom by taking on the guise of beautiful women, again, that shape-shifting motif.
Oh, yeah. That's a common thing you see in the Arabic stories, is that there's a female ghoul hanging out by the road and calling men to come over and see her.
Yeah.
And come over and see me sometime in desert ways.
And of course, that's a wonderful, a classic monster trope that we continue to play with today.
Yeah.
But then, of course, also sometimes they break into your storerooms and they munch on your dates.
Right. I think that's what Muhammad was mentioning. Right?
Yeah. But some of the key early adapters, if you will, to ghouldom were Poe, Lord Byron, and Hans Christian Andersen.
What?
Yeah. They all made mention of ghouls. In the 19th century, in their writings.
What did Hans Christian Andersen write about ghouls?
It's just in one particular story, and I don't think they play a huge role, but they pop up. Like, clearly they were, one of the many magical creatures he was privy to.
And they're just in the mix. They're in the cultural miasma.
Yeah. So they end up picking them up, playing with them to a certain degree. And then you have a new generation come along in the 20th century. Lovecraft, of course, H.P. Lovecraft, who we've mentioned. Other weird fiction authors of the day, including Clark Ashton Smith, who wrote some wonderful ghoul stories. They continue to cultivate ghouldom in a new dark form, tying it in with some of the dark, weird motifs that are a part of weird fiction. Particularly in Lovecraft's case, you have Pickman's Model. Which you read, correct?
Yeah. Robert told me before this episode that I should read Pickman's Model, and I did. It was very interesting. And it also, one of the interesting things about it to me is that it is different from all these other stories that where we've been saying that the ghoul is sort of on the periphery as a scavenger on the outside, trailing behind the camp or whatever. In this story, the ghoul emerges as a feature of a sort of shadowy meta-city, shadowy city within a city, that there's a part of the city that the narrator is taken to by Pickman, who's this creepy artist who draws creepy things, or I guess paints creepy things. And they go to his house in this bizarre part of the city where suddenly there are tunnels going back to seemingly maybe back in time to Salem and witchcraft and monstrous things may be emerging from them. And it's right there in the heart of Boston in that story, right?
Yeah, it is. There's very much this feeling that the ghoul kind of resides in the city's history as well as in its architectural history. So there's a sense that the bodies that the ghouls feed on are not even current graves. They're kind of feasting on the past. So Pickman's Model is a key work in the Western ghoul, and we see here that it really gets its claws into our horror literature.
Yeah, there are several key scenes describing paintings of ghouls eating the dead flesh of human beings.
Right. And from here, this spreads. Lovecraft, of course, is hugely influential. And so his idea of ghouldom spreads into various works of fantasy and dark fantasy. Again, Clark Ashton Smith, Brian McNaughton, Neil Gaiman more recently. And you even see ghouls show up in the Harry Potter series, though not that convincingly.
Now, if we're going to go with the D&D model, what type of creature would you say Lord Voldemort is? Is he more of a lich, or he's kind of got some ghoul features, right? Doesn't he?
I feel like he's a variation on the lich,
Okay.
Like what with the whole storing of the soul and the various horcruxes,
yeah.
But he has a ghoulish appearance for sure.
Yeah. Now, I was curious. I didn't have time to look this up before we recorded, but I just had the thought. What about the Nazgul in Tolkien? Do you think that the ghoul in Nazgul, meaning the Nazgul or the ring wraiths in Lord of the Rings, these evil spirits who are obsessed with finding the ring of power and they want to grab it and bring it back to their master. And I believe the word Nazgul means ring wraith. And so the ghoul there being some kind of evil spirit, I wonder if Tolkien was inspired by the Arabic word ghoul there.
Well, you know, I'm not that much of a Tolkien scholar, so we'd have to I'd have to call out for our listeners to see if anybody has any insight on that. But and I don't know to what extent he was interested in Arabic culture and Arabic languages. I know he was certainly into language, and it seems completely plausible that he would have been familiar with these tales. So I would, if I had to bet on it, I would say, yeah, he surely the Nazgul has its origins in pre-Islamic Arabic folklore.
Okay.
And of course, we continue to see great works of horror and other fictions that involve the ghoul. Catelyn R. Kiernan has a great novel called Daughter of Hounds that deals with ghouls. I'd recommend that. Oh. There's a wonderful old weird tale short story called Far Below by Robert Barber Johnson. And this involves ghouls in the New York subway system. That's a great read if you can find a copy.
Oh, man, that does sound great.
Yeah, and in comics and TV, we see plenty of examples there. There's a wonderful episode of Tales from the Crypt called Morning Mess that involves a shadowy organization that seems to be very interested in supplying burial for vagrants and transients who die. But, of course, there's a ghoulish secret at the heart of it.
Oh, no. Now, I recall a particular Tales from the Crypt comic segment that I read years ago that was about – it was about a tale of – a sad, tragic tale of young lovers, and the woman dies.
Uh-huh.
And she – her body is entombed in a crypt, and then her lover is locked in the mausoleum with her, like locked into the crypt. And – he cannot get out, and he's trying to escape, and he can't. And then much later, the police find him, and they find that he actually survived in there for a long time. And the ominous ending is that they find he died of formaldehyde poisoning.
Oh, well, that's a pretty good one. I need to go back and read some of these old Tales from the Crypts. I don't have a lot of experience with the actual comics. But
I haven't read many either.
Yeah.
That's one a friend of mine recommended to me.
Oh, excellent. I'll have to look that up. So, yeah, we mentioned Dungeons & Dragons already, that the ghouls have long played a role in Dungeons & Dragons. They've always been in the monster manuals, both ghouls, and I believe – and they also have like an advanced version of the ghoul called a ghast, and then variations on ghouls that pop up in different add-ons.
So tell me just basically, what does your encounter with the ghoul look like? It's just basic sword fodder? Like, it's not very tough?
The standard ghoul isn't particularly tough or intelligent. The ghast is a little more potent and a little tougher to encounter. But they're not they're not high-end monster encounters, unless, of course, you're encountering them in significant numbers.
Yeah. But despite all this, the ghoul has never really, as you, I think, eloquently put it in our notes, exploded into the mainstream, at least not in the way that the vampire or the werewolf or even Frankenstein's creature has. You know, we never got the universal monster movie of the ghoul.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there have been occasional films that – I think there was even a Boris Karloff film titled The Ghoul. But,
oh, really?
Yeah, but it's not particularly in keeping with the
ghoul. Obviously, I've never seen it.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's just – I guess the ghoul is not that sexy. The ghoul, the ideas that it represents are maybe not as comfortably contemplated as that of vampires and werewolves.
Well, certainly not as sexy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing about – if you go back and watch Bela Lugosi's Dracula, it's very slick. You know,
yeah.
Dracula is kind of sexy. He's not gross and monstrous. The ghoul is disgusting.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's the big reason. But it continues to be – it's kind of like one of those bands that never really, you know, takes off into superstardom, but they always have their following, right?
Yeah.
So I would say that, you know, ghouls are kind of like the – maybe they're the fish of the monster world, right? Like, not everybody's going to have a lot of familiarity with them or be able to tell you what their top 10 hits are, but they have a hardcore following and they're not going away, even if, you know, some of the details about them, you know, are a little ambiguous. So we've discussed the folkloric, mythological, fictional history of the ghoul from ancient pre-Islamic Arabic traditions on up into the latest edition of the Dungeons & Dragons Monster Manual.
Yeah, but of course, the eating of dead flesh is not merely the stuff of fantasy. I mean, this is not only something you commonly see in the natural world. It is a standard way of making a living for many organisms.
Yeah. I mean, we've discussed on this show before in the past, we've discussed basic cannibalism as it occurs in nature. It's a very, when you strip away all the human complications, it makes a certain economic sense.
Sure.
You're just talking about flesh, you're talking about energy. You're talking about absorbing the energy back into a viable being.
I think a question we should keep in mind throughout the course of this part about science is the question of why cannibalism is such a taboo among humans. And obviously, I mean, it would be quite clear why violent cannibalism is so, like, you kill somebody and eat their flesh. But I'm talking about the kind of cannibalism that, as you just alluded to, makes a kind of basic energy economics sense. Like, your loved mm-hmm. one dies, and then we say, no, no, you will not eat their flesh.
Right. Well, I feel like the big theme here, and we'll discuss another possible theme in a minute, but the big one, of course, ties right into what we've previously talked about concerning natural burial versus modern burial traditions, is that we just get wrapped up in the idea of that corpse still being the person that it was.
Yeah, yeah. So we did definitely allude to this in our episode called Human Remains, Past, Present, and Future. But there is the idea that we can never fully accept that the dead body of the person we loved is not in some sense still that person, not in some sense still, in a way, alive. And thus, in that way, there really, among humans at least, may not be such a thing psychologically as nonviolent cannibalism. Like, if your cousin dies and you rationally know you're no longer hurting him by eating his body, you just can't on some level accept that. You're doing violence mm-hmm. to his flesh. And it seems like you're doing a harmful thing.
Okay, so let's go on a journey.
Okay.
Let's, traveling back down the highway of human evolution and human ascension. A road that as we travel, you're going to see some rather ghoulish characters standing along the wayside.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I think if we look back into early human history, we can see both of the major aspects of the ghoul, both the scavenger aspect and the cannibalistic aspect.
Okay, so we're going to travel back 2.5 million years to the dawn of the Pleistocene epoch, and you'll find our Australopithecine ancestors scrambling to diversify their diets in a changing world.
Okay, so these are people who are... they're not living a comfortable existence like us, supported by agriculture and supply to stores of food. They're living at the edge,
right,
at the edge of hunger. They need to find food constantly.
Yeah. And according to the 2014 paper, Humans and Scavengers, the Evolution of Interactions and Ecosystem Services, that was published in the journal Bioscience, we're specifically talking about increasing seasonality in precipitation in the African savannas. And this is forcing our Australopithecine ancestors to diversify, again, to cope with the developing seasonal bottleneck in fruits and other soft plant foods.
So it's becoming harder to make a living gathering plant matter.
Exactly. So you end up with two approaches, two responses to this bottleneck. Okay, you have some early hominids that turn to seeds and roots. They start diversifying in that direction. The roots are going to be available year-round. Seeds can be acquired in different seasons as well.
That doesn't sound very good to me.
Yeah, well, that's what this other group decided. And they're the ones who decided to try out some of the meat to be found on large vertebrate carcasses. But they're not hunting. Because we're not like hunting is a technological advancement that also hadn't come along yet.
Well, I mean, think about all of the deficiencies human beings have as natural hunters. I mean, mm-hmm. we don't have teeth and claws and powerful jaws like a lion or a tiger or something like that. We do have smarts and we can make tools, but we can't just chase down a gazelle and rip it apart the way that these other large predators can.
And that's what these early meat eaters had to do. They had to wait. They had to watch. They had to look for the signs, say, of vultures in the sky or the movements of known predators or larger known scavengers.
Strategic meat acquisition.
Yeah. Find where they're going and try and either pick up the pieces afterwards or try and steal it. Again, these are scavengers.
Yeah.
Their whole past is scavenging. And so if they're going to start encompassing meat into their diet as well, then they're going to try to do it through scavenging strategies.
Yeah, and you can even see this in what scientists say about the most ancient human tools we've discovered, because what do you think the first human tools are? Obviously, what would come to your mind is hunting tools, right?
Yeah, you think about like daggers and spears.
Yeah, spears, axes, stuff like that to kill animals with. And obviously, if we do go back to certain periods, we do find ancient hunting weapons. But a lot of what you find appears to be early tools used for the processing of animal carcasses, So not necessarily for the killing, but for processing, for like a butchery.
Yeah, like very much the idea of finding the body and needing to get that marrow out, right? Trying to get some meat out of this this dead large vertebrate that can sustain you, but you're going to have to use your tools to do it.
Yeah, it's a smart strategy, and hominids are not the only animal species that has ever tried it. But yeah, you look to what the predator has already done, and then you engage in kleptoparasitism.
Yes,
the stealing parasitism. You take advantage of their work and claim it for your own.
Yeah, and if you take it to the next level, you engage in confrontational scavenging. So this is and this is something we still see to this day. In rare instances, these are the kind of traditions that, you know, may not survive too much longer in our modern world. But there are Cameroonian villagers who continue to steal meat from lion kills to this day.
I mean, it's a smart strategy.
Yeah.
It totally makes sense.
The lion has done the work, and if you can bluff your way in just long enough, to scare him away enough to where you can cut off a little bit of the kill and run off with it, and then instead of coming after you, they'll just return to their own kill to harvest the rest of the meat for themselves.
Yeah. You can bribe the lion with the work it's already done.
Yeah, bribe it with the work it's already done, steal just enough to where they're not going to miss it and come after you. Now, over time, this eventually develops into more powerful hunting skills, right? We develop the technology and the strategies and the brain power to not only drive away the hunters, but to usurp their role as hunters. And according to that paper published in the journal Bioscience, quote, the close association between human hunters and vertebrate scavengers probably played a role in the diversification of cultural services. So this is interesting because we're all used to these motifs of the early hunter and gatherer, right?
Yeah.
And we tend not to think about scavenging too much in that scenario. We don't think about the ghoulish history of human ascension and the idea that there was a time where we're essentially hyenas, we're essentially vultures. And maybe that's one of the reasons that the idea of the ghoul still is so repellent, because it does mirror our own history.
Well, there is something that we find inherently distasteful about scavenging as a way of life.
Right.
Like, I think that is very common among humans to sort of see it as essentially ignoble or unchivalrous almost. Mm-hmm. Like, it is honorable to hunt and kill your food. You know, that's a sort of an admirable struggle, but there's something just kind of like gross and unpleasant about scavenging and looking through, you know, trash piles and dead bodies and
stuff.
Yeah, or
even eating roadkill, right? That's probably one of the modern ideas.
Yeah.
That it's just, you tend to just attribute that to like, oh, that's a screwed up hillbilly thing to do, to eat the deer that you hit with your car. But really, why? Like, if you ran over a deer with your car and you're into eating deer meat and you have the means to process it, that's still a fresh kill. It's just as fresh as the one that the dude shot from a deer stand, so why not?
Now, if we think of these ancient hominids as, in a way, very economically conscious, essentially, they are making maximum use of what skills and tools they have to get energy resources from their environment, and the main way they find to do that is scavenging, even maybe kind of dangerous and scary forms of scavenging. Did they ever turn that scavenging impulse inward?
Yeah, that's the big question, right? Because it leads into concerns about, well, how does this scavenging creature, this creature that has learned the value of meat, has adapted to survive via meat, and then suddenly it puts new it applies new meaning to their own dead.
Yeah.
Suddenly, hey, I could go out and I could try and steal this body from a lion, but here's a dead member of our own community. It's made out of meat. I can eat that meat. And it's also worth noting, too, that eventually as we develop technologies to better process and cook meat, we're better able to deal with some of the disease issues that are inherent with scavenging, right?
Right. We reduce some of the natural risk.
Yeah. But why not? Why not turn to that meat, especially if I haven't really built up as much, human cultural taboos regarding the consumption of that food?
Yeah, and I think some scientists think that we did make that leap.
Yes, according to paleontologist Isabel Caceres, our ancestors likely turned to cannibalism due to lack of resources and competition for territory at critical points in their ascension. So basically, we're talking again about survival cannibalism. You find ways to supplement your diet. When it gets tough, you can scavenge for meat. But then what happens when that runs low? That's when you turn to your own dead and you give it a try.
Yeah. What did ancient hominids and the Donner Party have in common?
Yeah.
They knew what made economic sense.
Yeah. And it makes sense. We've talked about the economy of cannibalism. It's widespread throughout the animal kingdom, including among human and non-human primates. Because, sure, killing and eating your own kind tends to interfere with the long-term genetic mission of just reproducing and making more of yourself, but it works like a charm in terms of short-term survival.
Nevertheless, as I mentioned before, there is this intensely strong taboo against it. We just do not feel generally like this is an okay thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least I can I can speak for myself and say that, no, that does not seem like an okay idea. And it, I think, to most people seems that way.
Yeah, like even if the sandwich is really good and you're like, oh, man, this is such a good sandwich. In the back of your mind, you're thinking, but this used to be Ron.
Right.
Now I'm eating Ron as a sandwich, and that's really
Ron,
messing it up for me.
Oh, he's so savory. but there may be reasons for this taboo beyond what we mentioned before. So earlier we were talking about the idea that it's just hard to shake the feeling that the flesh of a dead person is not still in some way able to be harmed or in some
right.
way still that person. But there could possibly be selection pressures that favor a taboo against cannibalism, right?
Yes, and this is where we end up talking about Kuru disease and discussing prions. So what are prions? Well, prions are abnormal proteins that induce irregular protein folding in brain cells. And this construction leads to flawed brain tissue, resulting in progressive and incurable brain damage. One of the most notable examples here, certainly for our purposes in this podcast, is Kuru disease, which is found in New Guinea among the Foray people. It's a rare breed of disorder caused by this type of prion. Also, it's known as the shaking disease. That's what Kuru means, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes referred to as the laughing disease because scientists observed fits of hysterical laughing among those afflicted.
Yeah, and so obviously it is a fatal, very terrible disease that you do not want to get at all. But what scientists observed is that it only really tends to happen, though it's comparable to some other prion diseases mm-hmm. like CJD, but it only really seems to happen in the Foray tribe of New Guinea. And this is related to some of the rituals practiced by this tribe of endocannibalism, which
right.
sort of flips the script on cannibalism like we've been talking about. I mean, from our cultural perspective, we've got this taboo on cannibalism because we think of it as a kind of disrespectful or harmful thing to do to the remains of a person. But it's not necessarily thought of by everyone in that way. I mean, this is a sort of respectful cannibalism, the loving incorporation of a dead loved one's flesh back into your society in the form of food.
Yeah, taking your dead loved one back into yourself as food, into your body, taking their body and spirit into yourself. So it, in their beliefs and their traditions, endocannibalism takes on a form of beauty, really.
Yeah, so this, in a way that might seem strange to a lot of people, could be a beautiful way of looking at the consumption of human flesh, except that it did have this very, very unfortunate medical consequence of leading to Kuru disease.
Right, and doctors first really focused in on this in the 1950s when Kuru is popping up among the Foray tribes people, decimating whole villages, and the scientists quickly discovered that the only way to acquire the disease was through the consumption of contaminated brain tissue. So they just had to shut down the funeral rites. And that is how they were actually able to stop the spread of Kuru disease among these tribes people.
But the obvious idea here is if it is possible to get an extremely dangerous, fatal disease by consuming, in this case, I believe, the brain tissue of your dead loved ones, but possibly there could be other cases where consuming the dead tissue of human beings is a disease threat. Would there eventually be an evolutionary selection pressure against cannibalism?
Well,
would there be enough of a pressure?
That is an argument that's often made. However, I did find some work by medical researcher Michael Alpers. And he points out that the widespread presence of genes protecting against prion disease suggests that human endocannibalism was fairly common for thousands of years.
Ah.
So we see the genetic legacy of continuous endocannibalism, the continuous consumption of human dead, enough to where we build up a certain amount of resistance to these prions.
So why do we need a gene for endocannibalism taboo if we can just have a gene for endocannibalism, I don't know, shield that makes it safe?
It's basically like finding a cannibalism cookbook in your on your friend's bookshelf.
Yeah.
And then confronting
them with
it.
Why would you have this if you didn't?
Yeah. Right, right. Like clearly that we know what the secret ingredient is in the meatloaf now.
So it seems like there are some lines of evidence indicating that in the past humans were eating some grave flesh.
Yeah, I believe so. Based on the research material we were looking at, scavenging for dead meat is a part of our evolutionary history, and so is the consumption of our own dead. And therefore, the idea of the graveyard ghoul is very much a dark reflection of, if not who we are today, then at least of who we have been as a species in the past.
The scavenger.
Yes. So think about that the next time you you see an episode of, I don't know, Supernatural, I think sometimes has ghouls, or you watch an old Tales from the Crypt episode, or read some delightful fiction that involves the ghoul myth.
Well, unfortunately, as I said at the beginning, I think this episode is going to have to conclude our October lineup of creepy and monstrous content. But please keep listening, because even after October, we will continue to serve up to all of you intellectual scavengers some tasty and sometimes forbidden morsels.
Indeed. And in the meantime, be sure to check out StuffToBlowYourMind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find all the podcast episodes. You'll find videos, including the new monster science episodes that have been going up. You'll find blog posts, as well as links out to our social media accounts, such as Facebook and Twitter. We're Blow the Mind on both of those, and we are Stuff to Blow Your Mind on Tumblr.
And if you want to write to us and let us know your favorite appearance of ghouls in literature, or your favorite scientific fact about scavenging or cannibalism or any other eating of corpse flesh, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.